Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. Natural disasters can bring terrifying times. And after the storm passes or floodwaters are gone, the destruction left behind can be overwhelming. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, helps communities respond to disasters and rebuild. Have you ever interacted with FEMA staff, or has your tribe applied for FEMA assistance? In the next hour, we'll shed some light on the process tribes go through to access FEMA dollars. Join our conversation and share your comments and questions right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the pollock season wraps up in the Bering Sea, Alaska tribal leaders want action to protect declining wild Chinook salmon from bycatch. Last week, the Association of Village Council Presidents and the Tanana Chiefs Conference filed a joint petition for emergency regulations with the U.S. Secretary of Commerce and the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
In their petition, they suggest reducing the 2014 overall Chinook salmon bycatch hard cap in the Bering Sea Aleutian Island pollock fishery by 40,000 fish. Natasha Singh is an attorney for the Tanana Chiefs Conference. She says the tribes along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers want the secretary and the council to make the pollock fishery conserve the way that families along the rivers have.
There's not food in the freezers for our families, yet you see significant profits from the fleets in the ocean who are taking kings as bycatch. And we are pleading that for the sake of the people and the families in the river who depend on the king salmon to eat, they reduce the bycatch.
The petition calls for the bycatch hard cap to be slashed from 60,000 to 20,000, and the performance standard, which is a lower threshold to avoid penalties, to be cut to 15,000 for the remainder of the 2014 season. Historically, pollock bycatch spikes have occurred late in the season in the fall. Scientists say there are likely many factors that could be impacting wild western Alaska king salmon stocks, from food supplies and climate change to ocean acidity. Bycatch is one consideration. Myron Nanning is president of AVCP. He says after a summer of sacrifice, tribes are eager to see a commitment to conservation from the trawl fleet.
The state of Alaska already implements opening and closures on the river system whenever they feel that the returns of salmon are low. So we want that same requirement to be carried through with the trawl fleet out in the Bering Sea.
Federal officials say the pollock fishery has reached 99% of their available quota, and the bee season is expected to close soon. They add that the total bycatch is expected to be under 15,000. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Tribal leaders met in Washington, D.C. recently with U.S. lawmakers and the Obama administration. One of the top issues was voting rights. With more from Capitol Hill is Matt Laszlo.
Last year, the Supreme Court nullified a section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, one that gave the Justice Department control over some state and local voting regulations. The White House and congressional Democrats condemned the decision, which they say threatens suffrage for many people today. Assistant Interior Secretary Kevin Washburn leads the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He's urging natives to keep pressure up on policymakers.
So I strongly urge you to get out the native vote and to talk up the Voting Rights Act. The Justice Department's been doing great work around the Voting Rights Act and keeping attention on that and ensuring that there's a right to vote, but we have to exercise that right.
In the spring, Senator Mark Begich introduced the Native Voting Rights Act, which the Alaska Democrat hopes will amend the Voting Rights Act to ensure native language speakers can make sense of ballots and that polling places accept tribal identification cards. Begich says Alaska Natives are hurt by the poor compensation offered to would-be employees of remote polling locations.
But when now you can't even get them staffed, guess what happens? The booths aren't open, or they're not allowing the early vote because there's no one there. And who's going to work for 60 cents an hour? And it's basically geographic discrimination as well as, I believe, Alaska Native discrimination based on where they live.
Senator Begich is in the midst of a tight reelection campaign. His race is one on which party control of the Senate could hinge, and one in which Native American voters could make all the difference. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. When a disaster hits our community, the first responses is to get to safety. The next step is to assess and take care of the damage that was caused. And often in our tribal communities, repairing the damage that we can hear or that when it hits means reaching for outside help. And the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is a federal entity that has a system to help communities in need, including Native American and Alaska Native Nations. And over the years, tribes have reached to FEMA when they have been hit hard by natural disasters, some of which are linked to climate change. And today we'll take a closer look at what happens when tribal nations reach out to this agency. We want to hear your accounts of what you've seen and how aid has been administered to your community, maybe even your own village or town. And do you think tribes are a priority in the eyes of FEMA? Also, what approach do you think tribes should be taking to make sure their communities are safe when disaster strikes? Join our conversation right now by calling 1-800-996-2848. And here in Studio 49 with us today, we have Phoebe Suena. She is the FEMA Project Manager for Cochiti Pueblo, and she also supports other pueblos and two non-tribal entities through FEMA disaster process. And Phoebe is Cochiti Pueblo and San Felipe Pueblo. And we'd like to go ahead and welcome her here now. Welcome to Native America Calling, Phoebe.
Good morning, Tara. Thank you for having me.
And Phoebe, you know, we really appreciate you giving us, you know, a tribal view of what it means when, you know, a natural disaster occurs and, you know, how it's affecting our communities. And so can you give us a view into, you know, recently, you know, what kind of natural disasters have really impacted tribes here in New Mexico?
Well, in 2013, we actually had two presidential disaster declarations for the entire state of New Mexico, and that was for heavy precipitation and subsequent flooding in July of 2013 and of September 2013. But I'd like to also add that Santa Clara was one of the first Pueblo communities that issued requested disaster funding from the federal government directly to the Pueblo. So they had two other disaster declarations. So most of it was related to flooding in this area.
All right. And again, we are also, you know, extending the invitation to you to this conversation. You know, what kind of disasters have impacted your part of the country? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Phoebe, you know, we can talk about this, you know, in terms of these things have happened. But what about the people? You know, what have these impacts have meant to people who are living in these communities?
And that's a very good question, Tara, because many of the communities, especially here in the Southwest and in New Mexico, are unfamiliar with the impacts of climate change. Now that we're seeing it both in the fires that have been taking place, the extreme wildfire conditions, and then the subsequent flooding, along with long-standing heavy bouts of heavy precipitation. And because of that, it's impacting communities, but as well as individuals in the communities. We're having families displaced. In some of the communities, we have over 100 homes that were significantly damaged by heavy precip, and then therefore the traditional home structures, which in the American Southwest were not designed for week-long heavy precepts. So we have infiltration of moisture in the homes, causing mold in the homes, and therefore creating a health and safety situation for many of the families and a number of communities here in the Southwest.
And what are some of the things people are saying in the communities? You know, do they understand that, this type of thing, there is aid available?
No. So FEMA here in the Southwest has been new, I would say, within the last year of realizing that there's this type of funding available. And as federal government has their trust responsibility to the tribes, this is just another avenue that tribes can access for the federal government to meet those trust responsibilities.
All right. Again, we are inviting you to join us. You know, what are you witnessing in your own community? How have communities who have been impacted by natural disasters like flooding, extreme weather, maybe even fire, you know, how are your communities coping? We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. And has your tribe connected with FEMA? Do you have any accounts to share? We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. And Phoebe, you know, let's talk about just exactly what is a natural disaster. You know, how would you define that?
A natural disaster, in terms of the FEMA language, is anything that fire, flood, drought is also included in the natural disasters. Those that are, beyond your normal man-made disasters, where a man-made disaster would be, like a bombing or a chemical hazardous spill, where natural disasters is more, as they say, within God or the spirit's realm, in terms of happening where it's not necessarily man-made, but now we're having climate change, where there's some conversation over what is man's contribution to climate and the shifts in how weather is, wildfire, the various environmental conditions happening.
And so when you hear, a lot of talk nationally and just, just this weekend, the dialogue about climate change has lifted with things going on in New York City and the march there. When you hear it nationally, but when you really see it in your own community, how do you feel that changes things where you're seeing these effects to homes?
Definitely. After the Las Conchas fire in 2011, and then therefore the subsequent post-fire flooding there at Cochiti Pueblo, it became very obvious to the folks there, the elders and the young kids, of their impacts to their immediate environment. And where I've worked at up the road at the DOE LANL National Laboratory site, where there's protocols in place for emergencies. But when you start looking at a community, what are the protocols in place? Say, if you do get a huge amount of water coming down, how do people evacuate safely? How do we make sure people are safe in those situations? And so that shift in terms of trying to get the communities to realize the impacts to their immediate environment has been a very long educational process here in the last few years.
And what's been some of the feedback that you've heard as the education process goes?
Again, working with the communities is a whole nother level, because you want to educate while not scaring the community and scaring the community members, but bringing them up to speed on what needs to happen and what could happen without, getting young kids or the elders scared. Because we had a number of events here in the last few years where we had voluntary evacs because we had a wave of surge coming down of water and debris from the fire area. We had about 7,000 to 9,000 cubic feet per second coming right toward the Pueblo, and educating the folks that, look, we've got mitigation measures in place. If we do need to call an evacuation, here are the steps that we will need to take. And thankfully, within a lot of these tribal communities, there's a historical protocol in place. We have officers, our fiscales, our other governor's officers to help facilitate that process. But that said, is even those folks need to be continually educated and brought up to speed on what is the best way, because we can't just have chaos in some of these situations.
All right. And when you say evacuate, you mean evacuations, right?
Correct. Sorry.
Okay. No worries. And, we also want you to join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Phoebe, when we think about this and, you know, you get that dialogue rolling of being prepared, any thoughts about how you might be having to introduce a new way of thinking? Because sometimes being prepared looks like welcoming the disaster. Can you share some more on that, please?
Yes. So in working with a number of the tribal communities, some of the traditional thoughts is if you prepare for the negative, you're almost welcoming that those events or those thoughts or negative aspects into your community and into your immediate or long-term future. But let's look at some of these disasters or some of these potential disasters in a more positive way in terms of how do we make our communities more resilient. I take some of the Pueblo communities, for example. When we look at where they located Pueblos, where they located homes, where they located assets within their communities, they were above the 100-year and maybe even 1,000-year floodplain. So in these most recent floods, like I take Bandelier as an example, is all the kiva structures and the building structures were actually built above the 100-year and 1,000-year floodplain. And even there at Cochiti, when we begin to work with the Army Corps to run models over what's a 100-year flood and what will be the impact to Cochiti Pueblo, what was very interesting is the core part of the Pueblo, the plaza, the traditional buildings, those were actually above the 100-year floodplain. So those are just indications and data points saying that our forefathers, our ancestors, really did look at these aspects in terms of how to make our communities resilient. And in Pueblo communities, for example, we have, practices of saving seeds, of preparing for the next year. But all of those little actions in a proactive manner and in a positive way help make the communities more resilient. They're not necessarily preparing for the disaster, say a drought or something like that, but those positive aspects of preparing for to make our community stronger, to make our community more resilient, those actually help do mitigate the negative potential aspects of the future.
And has there been any pushback from the community in just reminding them in these ways or even celebrating our architects that came before us? You know, is there any pushback when you do say this is being resilient?
No, actually, then light bulbs go off and say, oh, wait, we don't need to think of it as we're welcoming negativity or welcoming the bad into our village. We did used to think about those are our ancestors. And so actually, there's been a shift and a movement in acknowledging that, look, that's what made our community strong. We've got to look back to our traditional teachings, our traditional stories, and our ancestors have been around for hundreds, thousands of years, and they survived through flood, drought, war, I mean, all types of various disasters, and we're still here as Pueblo people. So let's look at those lessons learned from those stories and teachings. And so what's been interesting and very heartwarming for me is that in talking to some of the elders through many of these communities, we're learning that, oh, yeah, well, my sapapa or my grandpa used to think like that. They used to tell me about this. Well, let's bring those stories back and let's remember the lessons from those stories.
All right. Thank you for that, Phoebe. Here in studio with us today, we have Phoebe Suena. She is the FEMA project manager for Cochiti Pueblo. She also works with other tribes here in New Mexico and some other entities through the FEMA disaster process. And if you have any questions for Phoebe, you can call into 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And you know, what about your own community? Did advice from our elders or maybe generations past, Did their advice on being prepared, is that what got you through the latest natural disaster to hit your community? Or, you know, are there some things we need to remember? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And what about when there are times where we do need to, you know, get aid from outside sources like FEMA? We want to hear what you think about that too. 1-800-996-2848. I want to bring in another guest who can also talk about another part of the country. We have Melanie Banky, and she is the president of the CARAC, and this is a regional Native nonprofit corporation and tribal consortium of the Bering Strait region of Northwest Alaska. And Melanie is a tribal member from the Native village of Savunga, and I want to go ahead and welcome her to the hour. Welcome to Native America Calling, Melanie.
Native America Calling. Thank you, Native America Calling, for having me on the show. My Yupik name is Akehkukar, and you mentioned I'm the president of CARAC in Northwest Alaska. So really excited that you're having this discussion. It's timely, especially as the UN is in the news today for the climate change summit that is going on. And we here in Alaska, especially Northwest Alaska, are at ground zero for climate change, which is causing severe fall storms. And we've had disaster declarations twice now in the last 3 years, meaning presidential disaster declarations. So I'm so pleased that you're focusing on this issue and that you invited me to be part of your show today.
Well, Melanie, it's great to connect these two spaces, especially these indigenous communities who, you know, have something to say about what this all means. And Melanie, were you able to relate to what some of Phoebe shared about advice our elders left us on how to deal with our changing world?
Well, one thing I'll let you know about our region is that we typically used to follow the game and located ourselves in places that were safe for us. We were migratory, relatively migratory, so our people knew how to keep themselves safe. It wasn't until the missionaries came and required mandatory schooling that we were required to settle in one spot. And typically the places that were chosen were on the shoreline, where it was easy for missionaries to bring in the materials and supplies to build schools. So while it provided for easy access for them, it also placed us in very vulnerable locations. We're coastal. And so what we're dealing with the climate change right now is that we've got less and less shore ice. Our ocean typically freezes over in the fall time, and that's happening much later in the year. We've got permafrost that's thawing, so we've got erosion and severe fall storms that are putting our people in danger. So what I will say about what our people used to know is that they used to know where to go to keep safe.
All right, Melanie, thanks for that. Again, 1-800-99-NATIVE is the number to connect with us today. And Melanie, as we talk about different things that have faced communities there in Alaska, you know, what natural disasters have tribes in the area faced in recent years? Any specific ones to name of?
Well, we've fall of 2011 and fall of 2013, we had severe fall storms. We had flooding. And like I said, both fall storms were declared a disaster. We actually had some homes that were lifted up off their foundation. People lost their fish racks, their subsistence nets, their food caches. So it was not a good situation. Okay. We had one village that, just as an example, lost communication with the outside world, had a power outage. The storm surge came in so quickly that there were a few families that were caught in the middle of the storm surge, freezing ocean water up to their hips, basically, and they were trying to wade through this, and there's debris, and this community also doesn't have water and sewer, so there were honey buckets floating around in this flood water, and one of the heavy equipment operators managed to rescue them by putting them in the bucket of a loader to get them to safety. So
These are real storms that are happening. You hear about storms like Hurricane Sandy and what happened in New Orleans, but this is also happening. Although we have smaller populations, it is happening to us. A family in Stebbins, Alaska is affected just like a family in New Orleans is when they're displaced. In fact, even more so because we have fewer resources here and we're so remote. Most of our communities you can only get to by small airplane. And barges are only arriving in the summertime, so it's very challenging when our people are affected by these fall storms.
And Melanie, I want to do a call out to our listening audience, too. You know, if you are in Alaska and, you know, you've witnessed something similar, we want to hear from you, too. And do you think that more people, you know, need to know about what people are facing in Alaska? And what about when it comes to aid? Who is there to respond? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Melanie, you know, when we do talk about who is there to respond and help, you know, how would you answer that question? Who is there to respond when some of these different natural disasters occur?
Well, first of all, the community leaders responded. They were the first responders. They handled getting everybody to safety. We don't have evacuation roads. We don't have emergency shelters. So the schools were the site selected because they're up higher and large enough to hold most of the people when we had these disasters. But definitely it was the local people who, with whatever resources they had and by whatever means that they could, that responded first. And then second in was Red Cross. Red Cross was actually a lot quicker to respond than FEMA. The fall storm that I mentioned that occurred in 2013 happened in the fall, and FEMA arrived on the ground in June. So at least 6 months later, we had FEMA there for the first time. So while we're grateful for the resources that FEMA does provide and the Stafford Act's new provision that allows tribes to apply directly to FEMA, bypassing our state governments, the response time and the training and technical assistance that, and the coordination with our tribal governments, the coordination with tribes and the state needs some improvement.
All right. And we're going to get more into that. And in the second half, we're also going to hear from FEMA. A representative will be joining us after the break. So if you do have specific questions, get them ready. In fact, call in right now because we want to hear from you. If you want to ask a question to FEMA directly, a representative will be on the line in just a few. And we are opening up the phone lines. We want to hear from you, Native America. You know, what do you think about this? When we talk about being prepared for natural disasters, does being prepared also mean knowing the right people to call or agencies to work with? Call us right now. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. And when we do consider FEMA, you know, have they responded to natural disasters in your community? And, you know, how was your community received? Give us a call. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And you can also send us a tweet. We're on Twitter. You can find us there, and we're also on Facebook. We're taking all your comments today. We're going to pause for a moment to hear about what's coming up tomorrow. A new study revealed that substance abuse for Native American teens is higher than the national average. Does this information come to you as a shock, or is this something that's been on your radar? On the next Native America Calling, we'll take a look at this issue and discuss what Native communities are doing to help put a stop to substance abuse among our youth.
Sacred Wind Communications education nonprofit, Sacred Wind Community Connect, is a proud sponsor of this program. Sacred Wind provides high school and college scholarships and internet training to areas of the Navajo Nation and Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico, where the parent company provides voice and broadband services. Sacred Wind believes that broadband technologies can reinforce Native cultures and offer other opportunities for self-determination. For more information, log on to sacredwindcommunications.com. The renovated Anchorage Marriott downtown, one block from the Dinaina Convention Center and close to restaurants and shopping, welcoming AFN attendees and their families. For booking information, 1-800-228-9290 and mention AFN.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and if you just joined us, we're talking about the relationship between tribes and also the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. And we want to know, you know, has your tribe reached out to FEMA in the past to rebuild after a natural disaster? And have they sent in people to help your community to respond to a flood, fire, or tornado? And give us a call. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And now we're going to bring in a voice from FEMA. I'd like to go ahead and welcome Beth Zimmerman. And she is FEMA's Deputy Associate Administrator for the Office of Response and Recovery. Welcome to the hour, Beth.
Thank you, Tara.
And Beth, can you do a little defining for us? We're talking about natural disasters and how Native communities are facing and maybe even having those discussions about how to be prepared. But when FEMA comes in, a natural disaster, it's been declared a disaster. So tell me a little bit more about how the process works.
Sure. I'm happy to. And thank you for allowing me to participate. Disasters, as we know, all happen in the community first. The first responders are those within the community, and then they look to get supplemental assistance when it becomes above and beyond their capabilities. So working with the tribes, as you know, we have just now, it's been about 18 months ago, had the ability to actually work on a nation-to-nation, government-to-government relationship with the passage of the C&D Recovery Improvement Act. So allowing us from FEMA to work directly with the tribal governments. Prior to that, we used to have to work through the states in order to provide assistance to the tribes. So being able to do that now just for 18 months, we've been able to provide assistance when we get asked by the tribal leadership to come in and assist them because they have put all their resources that they have in order to respond to the disaster and to come forward directly to us. So in working through that, we've been feverishly for the last 18 months working with the tribal governments under consultation. We have held over 60 listening sessions with the consultation that we've had for how we could work our relationship, as I said again, government to government for disaster declarations and what it means to get supplemental assistance from the federal government through FEMA's coordination with all of the federal partners here in the federal level. So when the tribe, I guess it boils down to when a tribe has a disaster and they are unable to respond to it and to recover from it on their own with their own resources, then they're able to come in and ask the federal government to assist them.
And Beth, you know, how does that work? You know, having this process to go straight to FEMA, how does that help things or how does it change things not having to go through the state anymore?
So I say it just opens up the lines of communications directly with us. As FEMA, we have our headquarters office here in Washington, D.C., but we also have 10 regional offices across the country. So each one of the tribal governments knows their regional administrator, so that's key.
that they know who that regional administrator is in our regional offices. And then working with them, we also have tribal liaison officers within each of those regional offices, as well as up here at FEMA headquarters. So being able to reach out to them to get assistance, there's been many, many tribes that we've been working with for years, if not decades, providing them assistance, whether it's technical assistance on planning, preparedness, but also in the world of recovery. So many tribes have already worked with us, whether it was through the state or on their own, but because it is an option once declaration has been made previously under the governor's request to them, the tribes could come in directly to us after that request has been made to provide direct assistance government to government. So hopefully by them being able to talk to us directly and to make that request for assistance, whether it be technical assistance or actual disaster response recovery assistance that's needed, hopefully they find that relationship working.
So, Beth, does the connection need to be made even before, you know, a disaster strikes? You know, does there need to be a relationship in advance by reaching out to FEMA? What do you think?
Oh, definitely. We encourage everybody to get to know your partners before that disaster happens. You need to know what types of resources can be made. So whether it's working here with FEMA, working with our partners over at Department of Interior, through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bureau of Indian Health Affairs, knowing all of those partners and the resources that they bring before the disaster happens only speeds up that process when you are experiencing a disaster, so that you know what types of assistance are available before and after disasters.
And Beth, you mentioned that FEMA has been doing consultations with tribes. What's been some of the feedback?
The feedback has been very good. I think it's important to note, I said back in January of 2012, we were given the authority to reach out to the tribes directly, for the tribes to reach out to us directly to get disaster assistance. And so we instantly instituted that, knowing that there's going to be things that we need to look at, perhaps tribes in Indian country, differently than we do states. So being able to immediately accept disaster declaration requests was key to us. So then what we did was we went out and we reached out to folks to find out what types of criteria we should be looking at for disaster declaration requests. So we did a very thoughtful process on that, came up with a document, a guiding document, and then we put that out for 120 days for consultation. And that's where we went out and we held over 60 listening sessions face-to-face. We were able to reach over 500 participants. They representatives of over 220 tribes. And through that, we received over 1,000 comments to the draft guidance we came up with that we are currently adjudicating.
And were there any concerns that people raised?
So, yes. I mean, they were looking at the current criteria that's in the regulations, looking at, you know, it's $1 million threshold to even come in and request a disaster declaration. And many tribes have expressed concern with that because they don't even own $1 million worth of infrastructure. So what does that mean to the tribe if they don't own $1 million worth of infrastructure, but yet if they were to lose some percentage or all of their infrastructure, how could they come in? So by them commenting, which we really appreciate, to give us what does it mean to them, what are some different ways we might be looking at for when a disaster request comes in from a tribe. So we thought that was very important to make sure we had thoughtful consultation, know the importance of being there face-to-face, as well as all the other comments that we did receive in.
All right, Beth, we got a caller on the line we're going to. Again, you can join us, 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're bringing in Ruth in Alaska, tuned in online. Ruth, what do you think?
Well, we went through, out here in the interior back in 2002, we went through a 7.9 earthquake, and that was huge. You know, the roads were closed, the power was out, none of us had cell phones then. And the Red Cross comes 3 or 4 days later with coffee. And I feel like what we really needed was an education to prepare us for the 1,300 aftershocks that were coming, to talk to us about drinking water, possible contaminations from our diesel tanks and oil storage. And I felt like we needed education.
All right. Thanks for that call. And, you know, when it does come to that and you're wondering, you know, where do we learn more about this? How do we educate ourselves? Have your tribal nation stepped up and provided information? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Ruth, thank you for your call. We got another caller on the line. We have Carl in Anchorage, Alaska, tuned in on KNBA. Carl, you got a question for us?
Yeah, I had a question while you have FEMA on the line. I Alaska is pretty unique, and, you know, the corporations have created big problems for tribes to be able to access planning and mitigation money, things like that from FEMA and other agencies. I was wondering if you could touch on if this new law that passed actually might address some of those problems in Alaska, where tribes have been losing out on their self-sufficiency and self-determination in these disaster declarations.
All right. Thank you for your call, Carl. Beth, that question is for you.
Yes. To address Carl's question, that's what this law allows us to, is to accept those disaster declaration requests directly from the tribes. And so we have been doing that. And the good thing about it is the tribes have the choice. So they can either come in directly to us. There is a non-federal cost share currently for the disaster request. So they would be responsible for that non-federal cost share. So some states or some tribes have decided to come in through the state because the states may actually provide some portion of or all of that non-federal cost share. But it's important to note that each tribe is able to make their own self-determination as to whether or not they want to come in as through themselves directly to us or if they want to come in through the state. So I think that's one of the most important things to remember, that each tribe needs to individually take a look at that, see what it means for them, and make their own determination as to how they want to make their request.
And Beth, will these changes mean FEMA services could be available faster? I understand that was a complaint in the past.
So, I mean, these services, I mean, as soon as folks, you know, request our services, we are not like the Red Cross, where the Red Cross is in many communities already working on a daily basis, providing meals to people, assisting when a house burns down. You'll see that Red Cross out there immediately. The tribal governments need to take a look at their own resources and be able to calculate, you know, when they're going to need our assistance, and then it's making that request. So we try to be on the ground when there's something, what we call our no-notice events. We can't always be there because there's no notice ahead of time that it's going to happen, such as earthquakes, versus when we look at things like hurricanes and tsunamis and that, where you have a little more notice. But it's something that, you know, once we're asked to come in, that's the key, and then we can get folks, you know, on the ground and assisting, even if it's providing technical assistance before they might even request a presidential disaster declaration.
All right, Beth, we do appreciate you joining us. Is there any place where folks can get more information online?
Sure. If they go to FEMA.gov, there's lots of information. It could be overwhelming, in fact. But if you take a look at that, there is a drop-down menu for disaster declarations, what it means to you as a disaster survivor. There is ready.gov, which also provides assistance to, you know, preparation. What do I need to do ahead of time? How am I going to take care of my family? What are those things that I need to be doing ahead of a disaster so that I'm prepared for it, so that when it comes to being a disaster survivor, I can survive and I can rebuild back what I need to and have my resources and needs taken care of.
Beth Zimmerman, thank you for joining us, coming to us from FEMA. She is FEMA's Deputy Associate Administrator for the Office of Response and Recovery. And we're also inviting you to the conversation. We're also talking about responding to natural disasters in Native America. And we've heard from representatives from New Mexico and Alaska. But what about your tribe? Have you dealt with a natural disaster in recent years? Are you still cleaning up, waiting for assistance? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Let's bring in a caller. We have Lauren in Cortez, Colorado, tuned in on KSJD. Lauren, what would you like to add?
Well, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a social worker, non-native, working for
Native Hawaiians and tribes across the country for the last 15 years, mostly doing cultural-based suicide, drug abuse, bullying, and violence prevention programs. And just last week, we were working with emergency management up in Oneida, Green Bay, Wisconsin, to create community-based events around the idea of preparedness so that tribes and communities are not just prepared before an event happens on the social and emotional and psychological level, but so that they can come together through cultural practices, teaching, stories, and music, aspects of the culture that can help tribes pick up after such a disaster and begin to tell the story that they're going forward with so that they can create that culture instead of victimhood, but of one of survivors. And where it really touches on is that we're all experiencing a disaster now, being detached from the environment, from the earth, from one another. We've all had suicide or murder or alcoholism or abuse or violence touch our lives in some way. And by exploring the trauma that we all are experiencing today, historical or otherwise, we prepare ourselves to not only help each other today, but to respond to something in the future if it should ever happen.
All right. Thank you for your call. What do you think about that? Also preparing emotionally. Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to Nikos in Anchorage, Alaska, tuned in on KNBA. Nikos, what would you like to share?
Hello. I work with the Alaska Inner Tribal Council out of Anchorage, Alaska, but I'm also on the board of directors for the National Tribal Emergency Management Council. We recently had our second national convention in Spokane, Washington, in Region 10. And in particular, we were greatly encouraged by how many FEMA officials from Region 10 and around the country attended that meeting. A lot of people are trying to get better disaster preparedness and planning capacity throughout Alaska. However, I think the National Tribal Emergency Management Council has expressed clearly that the federal relationship needs improvement in throughout Alaska. I wanted to let a lot of the tribal communities know throughout Alaska that there's a lot of pre-planning disaster preparedness monies that are available through FEMA, but it's a long process. And the outreach from FEMA is, they're just understaffed in Alaska. So the point is that it shouldn't wait for the federal government or the state of Alaska, for example, to make plans to help in a disaster. The communities have to become proactive, and the National Tribal Emergency Management Council is a really good, advocacy reference professional group. Also, we had these Arctic Shield exercises in Alaska where FEMA and the state of Alaska spent millions of dollars for 2 years planning to respond to a major earthquake. They informed every tribal community with a letter a couple years ago, but there was, I think, only one community that was part of those exercises. So that's an example of federal relationship and trust responsibility needs improvement. The Stafford Act's a great step towards that in consultation. However, we need to see monies for real programs so that we can really protect tribal communities throughout Alaska. Thank you.
All right, Nikos, thank you for your call. Again, there's still time left in the hour, 1-800-996-2848. And how much of this does need to go back to our tribes? Do we need to be prepared? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Today, we are joined by Phoebe Sweena from the FEMA and she is the FEMA project manager for Cochiti Pueblo. Also, Phoebe supports other pueblos and organizations, and she helps them to navigate the FEMA disaster process. We also have Melanie Banky, and she is the president of Kuwerek, a regional nonprofit corporation and tribal consortium of the Bering Strait region of Northwest Alaska. I want to welcome both of them back to the hour. And Melanie, wanted to start with you. We just heard from a representative from FEMA. Did you hear anything new, or is there anything you want to jump on right away?
No.
FEMA was just here in Nome, in fact, last week doing tribal consultations. So I do appreciate that we were able to have a number of our tribal leaders meet one-on-one, face-to-face with FEMA to share our concerns and provide our recommendations. I do think our region is becoming more proactive. These fall storms are new to us. I mean, the 2011 storm is called the Bering Sea Superstorm. You can actually Google it. We had it was comparable to Category 3 or 4 hurricane, and winds as high as 93 miles an hour hit us, and we had a lot of damages. So we're having to figure out what all resources are out there. How can we access technical assistance? I mentioned earlier that it's our community members who are the first responders. They're the ones on the ground. So as a tribal organization, and the role that COWERIC has been playing is trying to get everybody in the same room, figure out the resources that are out there, provide information to our tribes. This spring, because we felt like there was room for improvement in everybody's response to the fall storms that we've been experiencing, in coordination with our State of Alaska Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division, in conjunction with FEMA, in conjunction with our village tribal leaders, we gathered people to identify what are all the resources out there, what are the processes, and everybody was also able to identify what some of the gaps were and figure out what agency needed to do what differently. So right now I'd say that we're still learning. We're in learning phase. These fall storms are something that's very new to us, and I do feel like there are other parts of Alaska that are more prepared than we are and some that are less prepared than we are. So it's a matter of coordinating, and I think tribes do have a role to play. They're the first ones who are going to be able to respond, and the federal and state agencies need to look at tribes not just as an entity that's going to come and request assistance, but as a resource. Being the first ones there on the ground, we need to all be working in partnership. These are our communities. Although we are tribal members, we're also citizens of the United States, and we live in the state of Alaska. So agencies need to eliminate the red tape, the barriers, the bureaucratic barriers, and all work together, hopefully before disaster strikes.
All right, Melanie, we're going back to the phone lines. Let's bring in Robert in Santa Fe, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Robert, what would you like to add?
Yes, good morning. I guess one question that I had for either the panelists or from the individual from FEMA. I work with a number of tribal communities over here in New Mexico, and one issue that we've been having is the dollars come on a fairly timely basis from FEMA down to the state, the Department of Homeland Security, but as many know, some of our tribal communities do not have the resources to upfront a lot of these funds and don't have the ability to wait very long to get reimbursed. In many cases, it's taking the State Department of Homeland Security, you know, between 6 to even upwards of 18 months to get some of these projects reimbursed to the tribal communities. And that's been putting a very, it's been a real hardship on some of our communities. And I'm trying to see if any of the, maybe the panelists or the FEMA representative might have some ideas of how we could address those solutions.
All right, Robert, thank you for your call. Phoebe, can you help us with that?
Yes, Robert, one of the things that I think we need to also do is work, especially for those tribal and Pueblo communities that are working as subgrantees to the state of New Mexico, is to start to work with the state legislators and with the state agencies to facilitate that the process, because I believe there's like once from start to finish, once you get all your ducks in a row, you get about 40 signatures necessary in the bureaucratic process that the state has in order just to get funds to the tribes and or small communities here in New Mexico. So that bureaucratic process is lengthy, and it's also the roadblock in terms of getting resources to the communities, which is necessary when we have recovery for some of these communities. For example, in 2013, we're still waiting to receive funds. in order to recover from the 2013 monsoonal events, and we've already experienced the 2014 monsoonal events. So it's a compounding factor when those resources aren't flowing efficiently. And so in order to, in order to alleviate that, I think we need to also look at the bureaucratic process that the state has in order to facilitate those funds to flow more freely. That said, with the new Stafford regulations and the tribal entities having the ability to request funding and support directly to FEMA is a plus, but that said, it also puts added responsibility on those tribal communities to meet about 6 prerequisites before they can actually request those funds from FEMA directly. So again, you're looking at internal processes and internal resources that the tribe has to have in place in order to access those funds directly to FEMA. So that puts an added burden as well, in addition to maybe not having that additional financial match from the state. Like here in the state of New Mexico, it's about 12.5% that the state puts in, so of the 25%. So that alleviates that financial burden on the tribe. So I don't know if that helped address that, but I think there also has to be a two-prong approach, I guess, in summary, is to work with the federal level as well as the state level in facilitating the cash flow.
All right. And we are getting close to the end of the hour. Melanie also wanted to give you a moment. Any thoughts on how the process can be improved?
Well, first of all, the local match requirement is something that tribes in our region cannot afford. So it actually de-incentivizes tribes from applying directly to FEMA because we cannot come up with the local match that FEMA requires. And I think the process could be improved if that was waived. We don't have a tax base here. Our tribes don't have a tax base. So to expect the tribes to come up with that match is unrealistic. I do appreciate FEMA having come up to our region, our little corner of the world, to do federal tribal consultation directly with our tribal leaders. I think an outreach campaign to educate and inform rural communities on concrete steps that they can take to prepare for and respond to disasters and even man-made disasters. We're right here in the Bering Sea, and we have a lot of shipping that's going through our front yard because of the longer opening of the ice or being ice-free for longer periods of time. So I think the first step is outreach and an outreach campaign to educate and inform. And then the response time, being on the ground, boots on the ground after a disaster or even before a disaster.
Sure, that's critical. And I do appreciate you joining us. We are out of time today. I want to thank both of our guests, Melanie Banky, also Phoebe Sweena, for joining us here. Also want to thank reporter Laura Paskus for her help and New Mexico In Depth for their help in producing and collaborating on today's show. More information can be found on NewMexicoIndepth.org, and you can also learn more about our program by tuning in tomorrow. And we appreciate you for joining us. Thanks to our staff here, as well as with National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood. We'll be back again tomorrow.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.